Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning, wherever you are. This is Kicking In with Raphael, Season 2, Episode 3. We have a fantastic show for you today. A lot of great guests. We were supposed to have Joel Cardenas, our Barcelona insider, but he, unfortunately, is at a special job interview, which we'll keep you posted on later. Instead, very, very, very happy to have one of my favorite writers, one of my favorite soccer analysts, really covering the whole entire world, James Montague. Before we bring him on, we want to talk a little bit about him. He is the author of When Friday Comes, and we have the full title here, so we'll get it for you. One second. When Friday Comes, Football and War in the Middle East. He's a contributor to the New York Times. You can hear him on BBC World Football Show and also from CNN. I think he knows James Masters, who was on the show last week. Without further ado, let's invite him onto the show. James, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm all right. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming on. You know, it's a great day today in football, or this week really, because we don't have anything in the middle of the week. We're just completely ready for the big matches coming up on Friday, Tuesday, and throughout the weekend. And, you know, before we talk about the exciting matches or the big teams, England and so on, I really want to focus on this African playoff, James, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, no problem.
So over the weekend, we've seen the Muslim Brotherhood start to cause some problems in Egypt. A lot of people have died. We've seen problems in the Sinai, which is located parallel to Israel. A lot of questions about what's going on there. And today, officially, Ghana said, hey, we want to play in a neutral zone. We don't want to have that first leg played in a place where it can hurt our players. You know, as a guy who wrote a book about Middle East football, war, and everything, do you agree with Ghana on this? I mean, is Ghana doing the right thing here, trying to protect their players? Or do you think this is the wrong call, and you play no matter what's happening?
Well, I think there's two issues here. I mean, the first thing is that if I was a footballer or if I was head of an association looking into what was going on in Egypt at the moment, I'd certainly be pretty worried about sending my team there. You know, I mean, I've been in Egypt. I first went to Egypt in 2007 to see the Al Ahly Zamalek derby, the big Cairo derby, which is pretty much the biggest game in Africa, you know.
Right.
And even then, it was pretty tasty derby. We're talking, you know, so much violence between the fans that what they did was they had to have it at the Cairo International Stadium, so it's played at a neutral venue. And you'd get anywhere between 70,000 to 100,000 people to turn up to this game. You know, it was a huge, huge deal. But, you know, really what happened after that, you know, during the Mubarak years, the bad stuff, was these football fans, especially from Ahly and Zamalek, their ultras groups played like a really important role in the revolution, you know, and they played there in the front line in Tahrir Square. So football has been kind of intrinsically linked with the revolution and the post-revolutionary environment there. And so now, like, the fans, the football clubs, you know, these guys are kind of like the aesthetic of the revolution, you know, their flags and their songs, even the Muslim Brotherhood sing the kind of similar, these kind of revolutionary songs that they've invented. So there's been no football there. You know, the league came back briefly, but had to stop. You had the Port Said massacre, where 72 people were killed at a match between Al Ahly and Al Masri.
Right, that was horrible.
None of the home qualifiers have been taking place, you know, with any fans whatsoever. I was at the Mozambique game, which was their first match back in, I think it was July last year. And, you know, that was played even behind closed doors in a stadium in the middle of nowhere near Alexandria. So, you know, they haven't brought the fans back for that. They brought back briefly fans for the Al Ahly and Zamalek Champions League games and the African Champions League, but they've stopped them. So you can kind of see, when you've got 50 people being killed in protests in Egypt, you kind of see why the authorities both fear it and, you know, look at it and think, well, this is actually something that might go wrong. The only thing that I would say is that, you know, looking at I was at the Egypt-Algeria game back in 2009, and there was a lot of trouble there. There was a lot of violence, mainly directed towards the Algerians, but there was riots all across the world between Algerian and Egyptian immigrants in all sorts. Even in London, I watched the return leg and saw it happen in London. So I can see why the Ghanaians are being, you know, are looking at this. So I don't think it's just that they know playing in Cairo in a second leg with a massive crowd, or I say massive, I mean the stadium they're playing in is 30,000, but they're making a huge amount of noise. Playing that game as a second leg in Cairo obviously gives Egypt, I think, a huge advantage, knowing the passion for football and knowing what the atmosphere would be there, would be like there. So, you know, I think people might look at it cynically, but I can see where they're coming from, you know, to be honest. I mean, I hope it does take place in Cairo, and I hope the fans are allowed in, because, you know, I think that what Bob Bradley's done there has been, you know, is one of the great football, great sports stories of our age. You know, this American guy going over there, you know, and, you know, thriving really in the most adverse circumstances. I mean, this is the only team in football, in World Cup qualification, that's got 100% record. You know, and he's really put together a great side. And when you look at him when he was with the US team, you know, there's a lot of power there, but you're looking for the finesse. And maybe people thought that, you know, Bob Bradley was a very, you know, a coach who did it by the numbers. But here he's taken a team of fantastic, talented individuals and really molded them into a unit that is scoring goals for fun and tactically very astute. And, you know, this is his big test, and I really hope that they get to the World Cup finals. And if they don't have the home advantage, it's going to be harder for them, put it that way.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he has done a spectacular job. For everyone out there, BBC, I'm pretty sure, is just a great interview with his son Michael Bradley, of course, star of the United States team, and of course a member of Roma. Spoke about how much he admires what his dad has done in Egypt with everything going on there. And, you know, we keep thinking, the ironic part, James, that we keep thinking that it's going to end. You know, there's a periods of months maybe that, where there's some sort of quiet, and then after a couple months, you know, boom, violence breaks out. So we hope that everything calms down in Egypt. Let's look, though, at these other playoff games. There's a lot of exciting ones, and I want to talk about this one in particular because I think there's a lot of things to look at. Ivory Coast and Senegal. We could argue, James, that Ivory Coast has had the most talented players the last decade, yet they haven't been able to pull it together in the African Cup of Nations and in World Cup play. On the other hand, Senegal. I've said this for years now. Senegal, I think, has the most talent on their team. They just don't know how to play together. We see what they are capable of when they do play together. Of course, the 2002 World Cup. There are millions of Senegalese playing across the world. In Israel, in Europe, and a lot of Senegalese who, let's say, maybe play for the French national team because they were born in France, but their parents were from Senegal. So do you think, first of all, first question, do you think that the time that in the gold age at Ivory Coast is over, the players are getting older, Drogba's getting older, the stars getting older, how do you see this game, you know, for the fans of Ivory Coast? Do they view this almost as the end? Hey, if we don't make it to the World Cup this time, you know, our stage as having all these fantastic players throughout Europe might be over, how do you view this playoff match?
Well, I mean, of all the playoff matches, I mean, you know, of course, I mean, Senegal and Ivory Coast have got a huge World Cup pedigree in terms of qualification. No one can forget what Senegal did at the World Cup, you know, when they beat France that time. It's actually probably the least interesting playoff game of the lot. I mean, when I'm looking at the playoff games, I'm looking at particularly, for instance, the Egypt game. But, you know, I'm also looking at Ethiopia.
Amazing story.
A great story of Ethiopia. I mean, they've obviously qualified for the last Africa Cup of Nations, so they have this generation of players, and they're not just getting through, much like in South American qualification, where the home matches are won because the game is played at high altitude. But it's talking about the Ivory Coast. So people talk about what... you know, this kind of golden generation that has kind of slipped by, and Drogba's getting too old, and that team is getting too old. But you've got to say that when you're looking at Drogba's performance in the Champions League at the moment, he's still got it. He can still do that.
Right.
He can still bring that A game to the Ivory Coast. Senegal, yeah, it does have a lot of talent, but you've got to remember that with African football, you know, you get this. Teams will rise very quickly and fall very quickly. And it's all about, really, whether they can, because the scouting networks are very well established in Africa, a lot of the players are kind of picked up and taken to France or wherever the diaspora is. taken a move there, and they'll end up playing for France, or you know, all the issues that we've seen about Adnan Januzaj. You know, this has been kind of going on in this has been going on in Africa for years. You know, the talent being picked up and then moving elsewhere. So you know, with Senegal, we can't really look at past teams. I think this is just another fluky generation of players that come through that happens with every African team. That's why African qualification is so brilliant, because suddenly you'll get a team like Togo come from left field and qualify for the 2006 World Cup. You'll suddenly have, you know, Zambia. You know, I mean, obviously they had a great team in the early 1990s, but then that team was destroyed by you know, a plane crash that wiped out the entire team. But then they came from nowhere to win the Cup of Nations. And then you had Libya, you know, who are an absolutely terrible team for the vast majority of the past 30 years. You know, that suddenly they qualified that Cup of Nations, almost get to the World Cup. So, yeah, I mean, I think Ivory Coast will win that game. I think they'll qualify. I think it will be the last chance for that generation of players to do something. But I think, you know, Drogba in particular is a big victory. He's constantly been written, and he constantly proves us wrong. I mean, he's come back from a very, you know, from China, which is a growing league, but one certainly that isn't on a par with anything that's going on in Europe at the moment, or even in some places in Africa, and has come back and is still playing at a very good level of Champions League football. So I think that we'll see Ivory Coast go through in that one, I think.
Right, and of course, Drogba scored a goal in this past fixture of Champions League football. So, you know, you said it, playing really well. Going to this Nigeria-Ethiopia. Nigeria, of course, the biggest country in Africa population-wise. Yeah. A lot of things are going on politically in that country, too. Let's not forget what's happening in the north. Thousands of Christians have died by this Muslim terrorist group that's really might be the meanest of all terrorist groups in Africa that doesn't really – people don't really talk about it because it's – you know, not Al-Qaeda and all that, but it's still a group that's causing a lot of issues. In fact, luckily, I am close with the American ambassador of Nigeria, believe it or not, because I lived in Senegal for a year. And, of course, the listeners of the show know that, but I'm telling you. And, you know, he says that he thinks Nigeria could be the worst country in Africa now with violence-wise, yet it's not really getting the publicity from the Western media. You kind of just have to know Africa to know that it's going on. So that's going on for them. Ethiopia, I mean, is just an amazing story. If you go to Washington, D.C. and get in a cab, a lot of the cab drivers are Ethiopian. They're telling you it's such an amazing feeling for their country. It's the proudest they've ever been. Yet, I just have to feel, James, that Nigeria is going to win this battle, the two legs up. But what do you think? Do you see this...
You should see Nigeria go through here. You got to remember, Ethiopia have never qualified for World Cup honors before. I mean, Nigeria got a fantastic side. I mean, I watched them. You know, I mean, they weren't great in the Confederations Cup over the summer. I mean, I saw them play Tahiti, and actually, probably they were pretty awful against. I mean, they hammered Tahiti at the end, but I remember Tahiti scored, and you got to think that if Spain had beaten Tahiti 10-0, you know, and you've got a Nigerian defence that allows Tahiti, which is probably the worst team ever qualified for the later stages of a major FIFA tournament,
right,
to score, then you've got some issues. But, you know, African champions, they've got great. I mean, Victor Moses seems to be playing.
Great
move for him to go to Liverpool. You know, and constant, and like you said, you know, such a big country, you know, just produces a huge amount of great footballers, and they've managed to keep that kind of, probably the one team in Africa actually that's continually renewed itself and found new talent and kept itself kind of roughly at the top of the table. Obviously, they didn't qualify for a couple of World Cups, but they've been there and thereabouts, the African Cup of Nations at the last end. Ethiopia is the interesting one for me, because I mean, they almost ruined it for themselves.
Right.
They're in quite a tough group with South Africa. And the story really of the qualification campaign for Africa wasn't really what was going on the pitch, it was what's going on in the football associations, because everybody was making horrific administrative errors, which was resulting in the calculations of which teams were going to qualify from changing. I mean, Ethiopia played an ineligible player. It should have been a player that had been, I think it was two yellow cards or had been sent off. So they a game that they won was awarded South Africa. It gave South Africa a chance in the last game, and luckily Ethiopia got a result against the Central African Republic. Cape Verde Islands, I thought they qualified for the final round. Turns out that they'd played a player that should have been sent that had been sent off and shouldn't have played. They were thrown out, and Tunisia replaced them. Equatorial Guinea, I think it was, they had two matches that had to be the fixtures the result reversed. I think there were eight matches in the end, involving seven different teams, you know, or seven different teams being sanctioned for it. So Ethiopia very nearly messed this up. But I mean, Ethiopia have some kind of pedigree in Africa. I mean, they were one of the early adopters of CAF, you know, and they over the 60s and 70s, they had quite a good side. Largely, I mean, Eritreans were technically because of the Eritreans in the team when it was still part of Ethiopia. But they didn't do too badly at the last Africa Cup of Nations. I remember seeing them, and they played quite well. They had an American guy playing for them, but I don't think he's made it into the squad this time. His name eludes me, but they had an American guy playing for them as well. And I mean, you know, I think every World Cup needs a team like Ethiopia, or a team like Burkina Faso, or a team like Iceland. Or a team like Jordan, somebody that just comes out of left field, and that's what people want. People want an underdog, and for Ethiopia to come through what I think is the hardest qualification of all the qualification campaigns, but just because the quality is so high. I mean, I know that, you know, there's always the glass ceiling at the World Cup that the African team don't get past the quarterfinals. But, you know, in terms of qualifying and getting out of there, you know, you've got to remember Egypt have had the best side in Africa in 10 years, and they haven't qualified for the World Cup since 1990. So it gives you an idea just how tough it is. But, I mean, you'd say Nigeria all day long, really, given just the depth of the squad that they have.
Yeah, and Vincent Enyema has been a goalie in Israel for a long time. You know, I've been saying on this show for a while, I think he might be one of the most underrated goalkeepers in the world. Do you remember when Argentina played against Nigeria? Yeah. He had an amazing match. He's played in Israel for almost 8 years, believe it or not. It's amazing to see his development. He's played for Hapoel Tel Aviv here in Maccabi Tel Aviv.
I remember seeing it. I mean, the thing is with African goalkeepers is they get a really tough ride. You know, I think there's a lot of kind of under the counter racism when it comes to African goalkeepers. You know, that kind of feeds into a lot of people's racist opinions about Africans. You know, because a goalkeeper is a custodian, he's in charge, he's an organizer, he's the rock around which you rely on for the rest of the team. And so when you hear people throwing out these. Same with Richard Kingston, you know, you get the same kind of euphemistic phrases about African keepers. But I think you're right. I don't think he has got the credit that he's that he's deserved. And I mean, he could be going to a World Cup. I mean, that says his own story.
Yeah, I just think it's a shame he hasn't, you know, been able to play on a Lille, of course, a respectable squad in France. You know, has won before, but still, he barely got to play there, so he came back to Israel. And it's sad for me, you know, for watching him play so much. And he's an amazing, amazing player, terrific talent. He's shown it at the World Cup. He's shown it in domestic football league. So who knows? But let's move on now to another interesting story. This is kind of interesting. We're talking here a lot about politics and football here on Kicking It With Raf Bell. Season 2, Episode 3. Just to remind everyone, we're on right now with James Montague, who is the author of When Friday Comes, Football and War in the Middle East. And speaking of the Middle East and one of the most controversial things in the world, Iran. Iran has qualified for the World Cup, and they have fantastic coaching staff. We'll get to that later. We all know what's going on there and who's leading them. But, you know, one of the most interesting things to come out here in Israeli media the past couple days, I don't know if this has been picked up in other medias, is that the United States apparently, or you know, it's very confusing. I've been trying to get some confirmation from someone here that United States and Iran might try and play a friendly match before the World Cup starts. They've already both qualified. You know, it's a very, again, complicated thing with the countries trying to figure a way out to maybe start direct negotiations regarding their nuclear program. You know, we have the first phone call since the Iranian Revolution in 1979. So a lot of things are going on here. A talented team. You know, I've seen them play on the television a couple times. Obviously, I've not been to Iran to watch them play. Not going to let me in there. But they have a lot of talent. And I believe, according to Mark Serber or Daniel Carell, someone just tweeted last night that there's an American player on the San Jose Sharks who has just decided that he will play for Iran, I think, in the upcoming World Cup. He's decided to take the call-up. He's never played for them before. He's born in America, but his parents are Iranian. But I guess where I'm trying to go with this is, what do you think of a country like Iran in the World Cup, where today an Israeli minister estimated they've lost over $100 billion since the sanctions have put upon them? So much going on in the world. Do you think this team can bring hope and some sort of something positive to the Iranian people that are really suffering through all the sanctions on their country?
Well, I think when you look at, I followed Iranian football for a few years, and certainly the political side of it, because I went to the 2006 World Cup, and actually in the warm up to that, I went to Tehran to watch one of the warm ups. Costa Rica played there in the Azadi Stadium, which is magnificent,
huge from what I understand,
magnificent kind of concrete structure, kind of very 70s in its own way, but very retro. I remember it was my first experience in Tehran. I got there, got into a taxi, got straight to the ground. First thing I saw was a couple of hundred women protesting outside the ground because women aren't allowed in to watch the national team play. Which straight away kind of challenged some of my assumptions about Iran, that women were there and they're allowed to protest in this way. And they were protesting about football because it was so important for them to go to these games. And you've got to remember that when actually you talk about a USA-Iran matchup, the famous game was the 98 World Cup when they played each other. And what it was then, it was kind of, in 98, there was a very different political feeling there. Because Khatami, the kind of liberal president who kind of almost accidentally got voted, the Guardian Council kind of accidentally kind of overlooked the fact that he was far more liberal than, say, the Guardian Council and the Ayatollah were. And him going there, and I remember still watching this match, and it was just an amazing piece of diplomacy. You had the American team turn up, and then you had the Iranians, and they were just laden with gifts. They had like this big shield, and each player had flowers, and they were handing them over. And I remember talking to Ali Dai, who's the former national coach, but I believe still the highest, he's the striker with the world record for the highest number of international goals scored. For him, it was the biggest, they didn't care really about qualifying for the next round. They just cared about beating America. And there were, when that happened, the million people were on the streets in Tehran for this result. It was the greatest result in their history. And it was, it said something, there were reports of women taking their abayas off, but in the crowd when they were celebrating this. And so you went from that to then 2006, and I went there, and it was Ahmadinejad had just come to power. He was talking about pushing Israel into the sea and talking about denying the Holocaust and kind of hosting Holocaust kind of denial conferences and all this kind of stuff. It was when I got there, it was a very different place, and following the team was very different as well, because Ahmadinejad really is a football fan and controlled the not the team exactly, but the federation.
Right.
So, behind the scenes, he was the guy who, FIFA actually suspended Iran briefly because there was political interference in the sacking of the head of the Iranian Football Federation. So he was very much involved, and it was very different. So I followed them around in Germany, and there was big Jewish groups and pro-Israeli groups, massive protests everywhere they went, saying that these guys shouldn't play. Conservative politicians in England saying that the World Cup should be taken away from them, as a punishment for all this. So you can see how football seeps into things, and certainly when it comes to Iran and the World Cup. And you've got to remember the last World Cup, their qualification campaign really happened just when the Green Revolution was taking place. And there's a famous final game that was taking place against South Korea, and they had to win to qualify for the World Cup. And it happened right when the Green Revolution was taking place, and the players, when they came out, I think it was in Seoul the match was taking place, they came out with green bands around their arms, which caused a massive hoo-ha in back in Tehran. The conservative papers were saying that all these players should be kicked out and jailed, stopped from going back to play for the clubs in Europe. I was talking to the coach at the time, Afshin Gopi, who, funnily enough, was born in Tehran but grew up in California and spent most of his life in California. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, as he told me, you know, he was within the federation and within football, there's a lot of distrust of him being an American, you know, and he saw this all happen and that fell to pieces. But now it's a very different atmosphere. You've got Rouhani, who's this Twitter diplomacy that's been going on with him and Obama, and you've got this World Cup, and why not? You know, we talk about a ping-pong diplomacy in China in the 70s, it's Japan diplomacy, cricket diplomacy between, India and Pakistan. Why not use football diplomacy in this way? Why not use, a match to try and build on clearly what is a good personal relationship between Obama and Rouhani? And they're both going to be at the World Cup. I mean, what would be fascinating, if they're drawn in the same group. I mean, I don't think they've got a very young side. I mean, a lot of the players like Nekunam, and you've got, I don't think Ali Karimi's going to be coming back, you know. They've got really, I don't think that they're going to have the team to kind of really trouble the US now, which would be a bit of an issue if the Americans win. But, why not have this match? Why not do that? I think that's a fantastic piece of soft diplomacy that actually really could. It would be brilliant to have the US team step into the Azadi, step in there and show that, from my experience, certainly Iran is a very cultured country. They're a cultured people, very well educated. In the West, we see them as kind of Islamic fundamentalists who didn't want to do nothing but push the West into the sea. But when you get there, you know, it's not like that at all. There's a class of people who hold those views, but actually the rest of the people that you meet, you know, they're extremely well educated, very liberal. They drink, they have sex. The women don't want to wear the veil. They see it as an imposition and not a religious obligation. The young people I met were incredibly inspiring, and that was in the dark days of 2006. So, you know, Rouhani's talked about giving more rights to young people, and there's a huge amount of young people there. I think 70-75% of the country is under 30 years old. Since then you've had Twitter emerge, Facebook emerge. They're connected to the rest of the world like no other time in their history. So, I think Rouhani's going the right way, and I think a football match could. This is one of the few areas where football, I think, actually can make a big difference in things.
Yeah,
rather than just expanding the world around us.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. I've sent out a couple emails to contacts I have in America, and no one has been able to confirm it. If it's happening or not. What is really funny and kind of interesting, one of Iran's star strikers, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this correctly, but Reza Ghaghminejad, Ghaghushinejad, plays. I'm doing the best I can here. Plays in Belgium for Israeli Guy Luzon, so that is a story that I think could become fascinating. To have this guy who's on the Iranian team, 26 years old, very young guy from what I understand. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I just have his name in front of me, but I know he's a young guy who has scored for the national team. And I know that his coach is an Israeli in Belgium. So interesting to see what he has to say about the match in America. And also, where will the match be played? I truly doubt that an American team will go to Tehran and play there. And I also truly doubt
You never know. I mean, in 86, when I think it was in the Reykjavik conference, Gorbachev turned up and basically offered Reagan, Russia's entire nuclear arsenal,
Right. Well,
these things can happen when the feeling's in the air, when there is change, and he seems to have the Ayatollah's blessing to make concessions, then who knows? Why not go for the big stuff? I mean, you've got to remember as well that the issue of Israeli footballers and Israeli in general, it isn't a big deal to the people that I spoke to in Iran, it certainly isn't a big deal to the footballers. I mean, many of these footballers are playing in of Iran's football. I mean, actually, they produce a huge amount of footballers. A lot of them go and play in the Bundesliga. You had players playing in La Liga. I mean, right. You had Temurian, who played in Bolton. I think it was Fulham. He was at very briefly. All of these players had Israeli players playing for them, and it was it's never been an issue. You know, if there's one country in the Middle East, if you want to include a Persian country in the Middle East, like that, some Iranians fight, you know, we'll balk at that. But if you look at one country in the Middle East, actually, the people that I've visited have less problem with Israel than any other country, than it's Iran, ironically, given the amount of international pressure on it. I mean, there's only been one Saudi player that's ever made it to the outside of Saudi Arabia. Sami Al-Jabri played, I think, one game for Wolves. They've got a great league, a lot of money in it, attracts a lot of players. But, I mean, you know that if they had a player like Yassin Al-Qahtani, I think, who's the big player that never really made it. But, I mean, if he had gone and played at Manchester City and there was an Israeli player next to him, I mean, you know what it would be like in Saudi Arabia. They would,
right.
They would have called him home. They made it into a diplomatic incident. Actually, the Iranians have been pretty cool about it, and I think that's what people have got to realise is that it is to separate Iran and the Guardian Council of Iran, who are theocrats, who are whose views largely almost everything are behind the bottom, and with the people who are actually as European in mentality or Western mentality as I've actually ever come across.
Interesting. Very interesting stuff. You know, I mean, as a person in Israel, you know, we're sometimes not taught that. Whatever. We won't go there on the show right now. But definitely a lot of issues when you hear a leader of a country say he wants to wipe you out, and then hopefully, you know what? All we can do is hope for the best, and we'll see what happens. Before we go, before we let you go, if you have time, I hope you still have a few more minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna take a look now at what's going on in the EPL. This was fun looking at at everything in the world, and again, it'd be amazing to have you on after all these games to really touch up on what happened. But let's look now at this past weekend's fixtures, and I think we gotta start off with Man United. I mean, people knew that this would take time. People knew that just because. It's a talented team doesn't mean they're going to win immediately. Yeah. But personally, I never saw Manchester United struggling this much, though I have been very, very disappointed with their midfield. I think it's been a dismal disaster. I want to get your thoughts on Manchester United's start in the Premier League, not European play, just
I
Premier
mean,
League.
Not, I mean, it's actually not – I don't think it's that bad. I mean, you've got a new manager – he has inherited a team, I think, that has had question marks about its midfield for a good 4 or 5 years. I mean, that's why Paul Scholes had to come back and bolster it. That's why they still have a 40-year-old Ryan Giggs playing in the midfield. Nani hasn't stepped up to the plate. I mean, I know he's had some injuries. I think big things are expected of him, and he hasn't quite come through. And I think that he has, clearly, something went wrong behind the scenes when Moyes was appointed in terms of the transfers. That Manchester United tried a new tactic. You know, it's a completely different era now to the one where you had a coach who's kind of in charge of a multi-million-pound transfer budget. You know, you have directors of football, and you have have cold tears of people because it's such an important business. And something clearly went wrong. Every single midfielder they went for. Fellaini, I think, is a fantastic purchase. People forget that. It's going to take time for these new players to gel. But don't forget, they still have players who can come in, like Januzaj. Adnan Januzaj, who came in, and we were talking about this earlier, why are people talking about him? Well, at 18 years old, you come on, you score 2 goals for Manchester United, the biggest team in the world, you're going to become the global international story straight away. And that's exactly what's happened. I don't think that it's actually too bad a season. If there's one season that Moyes could have chosen to come in, then it's when basically all the top six sides have been in a state of flux. Mm-hmm. I mean, Liverpool have been rebuilding with a new coach and new players and trying to bed those players in. Manchester City have got a new coach. Chelsea have got a new coach. I know it's the returning Jose Mourinho. But, you know, that you've got Tottenham. Even Tottenham, although they had, I mean, I support West Ham United, so I absolutely loved the weekend when we were, you know, the 3-0 victory. but even Tottenham have got a team that you think, on paper, you look at that and the money they've spent, but that is a team that could, you know, could challenge for the title. So you've got all the way down the league now. It's actually probably the most open league for years. What would have been worse if, say, Mancini was still at Manchester City, you know, they were 20 points ahead by Christmas and Manchester United 10. You know, that's when the trouble really would have started for Moyes. I think actually this season he's got a free pass this season, and I think he's got a free pass at probably the weakest and the most open Premier League season I can remember in years.
Fun fact: I believe Sir Alex Ferguson finished in 11th place in the Premier League.
He had time, and there's a moment. I mean, there's a famous Mark Robbins goal, Mark Robbins, bit part player in Manchester United history, who scored. I think it was Mark Robbins who scored in an FA Cup game that kind of saved him. He would have been sacked if he lost that. You know, it took him a while to bed in as well. And it's a very different game to the game that Ferguson kind of started coaching in at Manchester City now, where the prize is so large. I mean, not getting Champions League football would be absolutely ruinous for a club like Manchester United, which has bought heavily leveraged, massively in debt. You know, suddenly Champions League income goes, that creates, you know, massive financial problems. That's when the whole edifice starts to crumble. So he doesn't have the time. So people say, oh, you know, we gave this time to Ferguson, so we need to give it to Moyes. He's not going to have that. But lucky for him, and it is just pure blind luck, given the fact that Mancini left, Pellegrini came in, you had all the other coaches coming in, Liverpool and Mourinho at Chelsea. They're just very lucky that he is having this first almost practice season. But he does, you're right, I think he has got to change his midfield in some ways, got to bring in some new blood. You look at something there like Juan Mata, who's being so unfairly castigated by Mourinho. You know, I mean, to have a player like with his talent and how he performed last season, to have him dragged through the media dirt in that way, and for a manager who kind of really protects his players as well. You know, Mourinho is a manager who really goes out there and says the most outrageous things to try and deflect attention of his players, make Mata the issue. You know, it's really unusual. You know, I haven't seen him do that in many players. And you think, well, I mean, if he's going to get rid of him, Manchester United got the money. Why not? I mean, you can imagine Mata at Manchester United. I mean, that'd be, people do pay good money to see that, but I pay good money to see that, and I don't go to see Manchester United. So, you know, we've got to say that there's, you know, you've got Januzaj who's come in and had a great first game. Obviously, it's just one game. You know, but then you've got two other great midfielders that Manchester United have left, that have lost. They've lost them. Ravel Morrison, who's had lots of problems at Manchester United. Ferguson said, you know, you've got to go, son. You know, he said he's got to get him out of Manchester, away from me. He had quite a troublesome lifestyle. Has gone to West Ham, and Sam Allardyce is, I think, starting to get the best out of him after some initial problems. And this guy was seen as even more talented as Januzaj, more talented as Paul Pogba. There's another one who's gone on to in Italy to have a great season. He's starting to have a great season there as well. So it's bad choices, I guess. But you know, I don't think you can write off Manchester United. I don't think you can write off Moyes. He's a great coach. I think the reasons why they hired him are still valid. And you know what? I think a fourth place, and maybe I think that would be them. I think they would be they'd be happy with that. Fourth place in a rebuilding season, but they need Champions League. If they don't get Champions League football, then I fear what will happen to them, really, because they've got so much debt, and it's so important now for the big clubs. You wonder really what could happen, especially if it goes on for two seasons. Crikey!
All right, that's that. Moving on now, arguably the most fascinating story of the year: Southampton, the Saints, 14 points through 7 matches. They're in tied for third, I believe. A lot of excitement. You know, you add the whole story of Ricky Lambert finally getting an appearance for the national team and scoring the game winner against Scotland when I think 3 years ago he played in League One or you know, one of the third division of English football. Just read a great blog on ESPN FC asking the question everyone's asking: can this team keep it up the whole season that they'll make even Europa League football? Personally, I don't think so. From watching them play, I have been impressed with watching. But as you said, I just think there's so much depth and talent in this league that I don't think they'll cut top four, top six. You never know. We saw the same thing last year with West Brom. They started the season really well. Also Swansea, but all these teams kind of fell off towards the end of the season. Still, though, through seven fixtures, they've done a great job. What do you think has been, you know, what's keeping this team so connected, and how have they been able to get some big victories?
Well, I mean, Pochettino's done a great job there. I mean, he's, he's a very technically astute coach. I mean, you've got, if you look at the players they signed, you think, well, Victor Wanyama, you know, I mean, he could have gone to a top four club anywhere in Europe, and he's gone to Southampton. You've got Ricky Lambert, who's, brilliant story. Like you said, has come from the lower leagues of English football, was working in a factory a few years ago. Has come through, and actually, he's such an archetypal English centre forward. You know, if you talk to people, if you talk to a lot of English national fans, their national team, you know, and there aren't many of us left, you know, because people have been so thoroughly disillusioned with the national team. We have these players who don't seem to be interested. Ricky Lambert, you know, of every, he's kind of what we remember when we grew up. He's kind of like, you know, the like a David Platt character or a Gazza character. Somebody you can tell kind of lives and breathes it. You know, has lived a life like us and wants to play well for the national team. I mean, actually, he's played okay this season, but he's now pushed himself into contention probably to start on Friday when we play Poland and Montenegro. Daniel Osvaldo, I mean, they've made some very, very good signings. Southampton also have a fantastic youth setup, and we think that, you know, I'm pretty sure Nathaniel Klein came through there, but you've got others, other young players coming through. Great goalkeeper, Lallana's, who's been brilliant for them as well. I think that you've got a team there where all the pieces have been put together, and it's a club that's been run in a very positive way, and I think in a very, very well. I mean, they had the owner who died a couple of years ago, and people worried about what was going to happen with the money that he used to kind of fund the team to come back into the Premier League. I think that, if like I was saying about Manchester United, and if there's one season where, you know, I think that there isn't a standout team this year, and if there's one team that if there's one year Manchester United would want to struggle in, it would be this season. Equally, it's an opportunity for an ambitious side that has been on the fringes to break into that top four and maybe snatch a Champions League place. And Southampton, from what I've seen this season, could really be that team. I mean, there are others knocking around that could be there and thereabout, but I mean, Southampton, you'd say, you know, fantastic.
And of course, Southampton was the team that brought up Mr. Gareth Bale, the highest paid player, or one of the highest paid players. So that's just fun to point out. But, you know, interesting what they've been able to do. And, you know, it's really interesting, that, you know, now that I'm speaking to you, to see how many Asian players we have now in the Premier League. I mean, 10 years ago, I could be wrong, but there were barely any. Now, it seems like several teams have them, and that's really great. I mean, it's great to see the globalization of football. Let's move on now. I know I'm taking your time up, and it's been such a fun time that we just keep going. Liverpool, I was speaking to a good friend of mine who's been a Liverpool fan for, I think it's over 30 years, and he said this is the most he's ever been excited. He's so excited about the connection that Suarez and Sturridge have. Daniel Sturridge, of course, with Chelsea, we never really saw him develop or boom, and he's really looked like a polished player at Liverpool.
Well, he did well at Bolton. You know, he scored a lot of goals. He scored a lot of goals where he's gone, actually. He's not done too badly, Sturridge, but I think he's really found his home. I think he's playing for what many people would, I mean, obviously it sounds crazy, a team that's recently won the Champions League, But in league terms, and that's what Liverpool fans talk about, in league terms, you know, they've been sleeping giants. You know, they've been in the shadow of Manchester United, you know. But let's make no mistake, Liverpool were one of the biggest teams in the world, not just in England, one of the biggest teams in the world. And seeing their re-emergence, I think, is something that very few people, apart from those within Manchester, would be sad to see. I mean, I remember growing up and detesting Liverpool because in the mid-80s, they had won everything. They were the Manchester United of the day. You know, they had the best team, you know, Rush, Beardsley, Aldridge, that great side, you know, John Barnes, and they destroyed everybody. I mean, apart from a little blip in the middle where Everton had a couple of seasons where they won the championship one year. I think they've just been really smart. Have they been smart? I mean, J.W. Henry actually hasn't been that smart. I think he's been quite lucky because, I mean, everybody knew when he came in and sort of thought about this kind of money ball football that he was going to bring after the Boston Red Sox, you know. And this kind of, analytic kind of way forward, you know, they actually spent a lot of stupid money on players that were horrifically overpriced. I mean, look at Andy Carroll and players like that, who I think is a great player, but isn't really suited for the Liverpool system. But, you know, they managed to get, because he was damaged goods, they managed to get Suarez. I mean, this is one of the most talented players in the world. And he's really struck up a fantastic connection. I mean, every year when people talk about Liverpool, is this their year? Are they going to come back? Are they going to win the title? Are they going to challenge Manchester United again? You know, I thought, yeah, maybe this is the year. They're always disappointed. And ironically, it's the one year where nobody's thought anything. They had quite no expectations of it. The season ended so badly with Suarez trying to literally take a chunk out of Ivanovic.
Right.
But Brendan Rodgers has done... It started, I mean, they had that documentary with Brendan Rodgers in Liverpool last season. You just thought, you know, this guy, maybe at Swansea he did a great job. You think, yeah, you know, this is a really forward-thinking coach. He plays a really great brand of football. Although he's still a really great brand of football in his team. But he came across a little bit like Ricky Gervais at The Office. He came across a bit mental. I was like, oh, hang on a second, what have they done here? But actually this season he's... really, really confounded the team's really confounded expectations, and it's the one season that people weren't really expecting much. I think there was a bit of, you know, resignation that this was going to be a kind of harder season, and now that they're there and they're thereabouts in the joint top class at the moment, probably the two best strikers in the league. Gerrard's playing well. They've got pretty decent defence. I mean, I think Toure looks like it's been a fantastic signing for them.
Oh yeah.
And arguably their best player at the beginning of the season, Coutinho, still to come back. So, you know, if Coutinho can come back, I think he's got another month now. But if he can come back, and work with those two players, then I think they're a really good shot for the title this year.
Yeah, we mentioned Victor Moses earlier in the show. He's on loan from Chelsea. Also, the goalkeeper has done a fantastic job, replacing big shoes. So it's interesting to note that. And Raheem.
Well, it looked like in the first game he made a horrific error. But I mean, anybody that's watched Sunderland or Belgian football know that he's a fantastic talent. He's a young guy. You know, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but goalkeepers do tend to come into their own a little later in life. And I know we're seeing this at the age of the younger keeper, ever since Casillas kind of came through, and people are giving keepers chances when they're younger in their career now. I think he's done a fantastic job since he's been there. And, so good, in fact, I've put him in the fantasy football league and I've not taken him out.
Okay.
That's the highest honour. The highest honour a player can be bestowed is to be the goalkeeper in my fantasy season.
Interesting. And of course, also Raheem Sterling, the youngster who I've always, he's so talented. I loved watching him play last season when he got minutes. Still very young, still very raw. Yeah, you never know where he'll be in 4 years, and he'll only be 22. James, let's finish with the Gunners, of course. One of the most, controversial, so many things. A month ago, the fans wanted to kill Arsene Wenger. Now that they're hailing him as a king, you know, now there's a contract negotiations going on. So things seem to, be horrible there and then great. And it's such a hard team. to support. My family supported the team since the 50s. My father's almost 80, and he's liked Arsenal since, you know, 60 years ago almost. So it's in my blood.
Yeah.
Wow, I don't even know what to say how we go at this. There's so many things to hit, but let's just stick with this one, and let's stick with the Turkish-German Ozil, who has recently come over from Real Madrid. He's just playing amazing. I mean, not just scoring goals, but his passing, his style. I mean, what he brings to this team, it almost is like, wow, it was that missing piece that Arsenal needed for so long. You could even argue is more important player than Van Persie. I mean, Van Persie scored a lot of goals, but what did he do besides that? I mean, I've really loved Van Persie, but you bring in a guy like
Come on, Van Persie. You know, I mean, it was a huge loss for Arsenal. They really.
Of course. They,
I mean, Giroud, I think, has started the season well. I think there's been some question marks about him last season. You know, if you're going to get one or two chances a game, you know, I mean, he fluffed his lines last season. I really want Giroud to succeed, if nothing else, because they've got that fantastic song for him based on the Beatles' Hey Jude. I remember when I watched it, I thought that was pretty smart. I quite like that.
Also, got Aaron Ramsey. Aaron Ramsey.
This is the thing. Ozil actually isn't the player that Arsenal needed. You know, but there are many other areas that Arsenal fans saying, you know, actually, I mean, because you've got Santi Cazorla, who plays a very similar role,
right?
And actually, kind of gifted midfield playmakers. You know, they had to, but Ozil is a world class player, probably one of the top five players in the world. I think it's massive. I mean, a fantastic piece of business to get him, even at that price. You know, Madrid are struggling without him in that position. A lot of Madrid fans are unhappy that he's left. And what he's done is people are looking around and thinking which players are going to be set free by Ozil. And at the moment, you know, the big beneficiary seems to be Aaron Ramsey. And ever since he broke his leg in that horrific match against Stoke City, people were asking, what does he bring to the team? What does he do? He doesn't score goals. He's not really a defensive midfielder. You know, what is his raison d'etre? And really, he's come alive under Ozil. And it does seem like Ozil has come in and knitted together that team very well. And you've got some other great players. Gnabry coming through, who looks like a fantastic young prospect as well. And I hope Arsenal do well, but I mean, just shows how fickle their fans are, unfortunately, because it's just, you know, one signing away from disaster.
Right.
And actually, they haven't been doing that well. I mean, you know, they did as without spending big money as well as they could do, which was continued Champions League qualification. You know, and we'll see at the end of the season, but you know, I think Liverpool, Arsenal, Man City, Chelsea, those would be the four teams. I think they'll be there and thereabouts. I think probably Man United will finish outside of the top four this season.
Wow. Okay.
I think. I mean, if you know, who knows who can come through and who can. But although, you know, I mean, Pellegrini's come in and he's got some. I don't know, it just seems that the type of club and the type of players that Pellegrini has at his disposal with Manchester City, you know, it isn't that much of a big step up from a guy that was in charge of Malaga, he's been in charge of Real Madrid, you know, he's been in charge of big clubs. And then you've got somebody like Moyes, who's making a huge step up into his first, you know, really top club job. You know, he's the one coach that is making that step up and kind of learning the ropes as he goes along. And I think that might be what means that Manchester United will finish fifth this season. But then again, you know, I mean, Man U have been written 100 times before, and they've always come back, and they've always confounded people. So who knows? I mean, City lost to Hull. So was it Hull or was it Cardiff they lost to?
Hull.
Was it Hull and
Cardiff? Hull, I believe. Or was it? Yeah. But no, I mean, it's going to be a great season, a long season. Arsenal, if they're youngsters, I mean, Ramsey, Chamberlain, Walcott, Jack Wilshere, we're still waiting for Jack to come back. You know, he seems like he's injured every 2 minutes, but he's so talented when he's healthy. It's going to be a great year in the EPL. I think, like you said, about 10, 15 minutes ago, you said it's an open league. There's a lot of teams that can contend. And then, you know, besides the big, you know, the big four, the big six, there's also a lot of fun teams to watch. And it's, you know, it's such an amazing thing here in Israel. The favorite thing to do on a Saturday is just watch Premier League, and then, you know, the match is also on Sunday.
Well, don't forget, you know, West Ham United, it was a result of the weekend, you know, 3-0 against Tottenham away from home with Jordan Morrison. You know, it was a great, great performance. So, tactically as well, not playing with a striker.
And
4-6-0.
Well, one of the biggest things with that match, of course, was the Yid word. We're going to talk about that actually with Mark Serber later on the show. James, this was an honor and a pleasure. It was absolutely great to have you on. Before we let you go, I want you to tell our listeners where they can buy your book, where they can check out your reading, and how they can follow you on Twitter, because it's I recommend following James.
Okay, so Twitter is James Piotra. My mother's Polish, so that's JamesPiotr. And the books, When Friday Comes, Football, War, and Revolution in the Middle East, and that's with the Coombsen books, and you can get that on Amazon. So either on Amazon.com or Kindle, or you buy the hard copy. Great cover of the book as well by Zoran Lukic, who does loads of fantastic artworks. He did a brilliant cover for us as well. So, buy it if you can.
Yeah.
Do with the money.
I think I'm going to buy it because, it sounds really fascinating. And it's interesting that how much football can really affect more than just, you know, it's not just a sport. And I people say sports are sports, but with what football can do, if you've been listening to the show this far, you see that football can affect so many things: politics, peace, nuclear bombs. I mean, it's almost the answer to all our problems, and it's such a beautiful sport to watch and a beautiful thing to follow. James, thank you very, very much for coming on here at World Football Daily.
No worries.
And
talk next week, maybe. When Iceland become the smallest country to ever qualify for the World Cup.
Yeah, I understand you're going there, so it'd be great to have you on and talk about your trip. And enjoy your time there, and we will be in touch. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, thanks, James. Thank you from CNN, New York Times, and, of course, wrote a really, really fantastic book that I suggest everyone goes out and checks out if they can. Sorry about that sound. Just technical difficulty. Online right now, Mark Serber from Fox Soccer, as always. Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, Rafi. How are you?
Good, good. Just had a fun segment. Usually you come on first, but this time mixed things up and had James on. And it's kind of funny. James knew last week's part in the show, James Masters. So funny football connection there. Anyway, let's get it going with some MLS talk. We've been doing that with you the last, this is the second week. You covered, broadcasted the LA Derby with Chivas and, of course, the Galaxy. The Galaxy romped them. I watched it on Channel 50 here in local TV, broadcast in Hebrew. Kind of funny that it was on here, but it's showing the MLS is growing. Last week, you really talked about the excitement of this team, how it's, you know, starting to come together with their new manager, but we didn't see it so much on the pitch. They really got outplayed in every way. What exactly happened, Mark?
No, exactly. I think, you know, they call it the Super Classico. It was anything but. You saw the gap in terms of the quality between the two sides. The biggest thing was they had no answer for Giassi. I mean, Zardes was just able down the flank. Mario Zola couldn't keep up with him for speed. They had no way of having other players come over and cover him. And then in this defense, Bobby Burling couldn't deal with the runs of Keane and Donovan behind him. And surprisingly enough, Bocanegra too was losing his marks as well. And that's what happens when a player gets free down the wing. Everybody gets preoccupied and you end up losing those runs down the center. And that's how the first goal was scored. And then, of course, Landon Donovan tying Jeff Cunningham for the all-time goal-scoring record with a world-class finish as well. And it was just the golf and class size is so huge. And the bottom line is Chivas USA has a good base, but they're not there yet. They don't necessarily have the quality that they need to compete with the best teams in Major League Soccer. And also at the same time, they were missing Tilton Oswaldo Minda, who's that shield in front of the back four and that link with the midfield of the defense. And I think that they looked really, really lost without him. But the bottom line is Geoff's artists didn't run high on the flank, especially in the first 25, and they had a better game plan as to how to deal with him, then the game wouldn't have been the way it was. But it was just all legality from the first whistle to the final whistle.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I watched it, and it was tough to watch. You could just tell the Galaxy dominated. Mark, you know, looking ahead, last week we said I think there are four fixtures left for most teams around that. One thing that I saw on Twitter this week, which was really interesting, I think the attendance for this weekend's matches were 19,000, and that was without the attendance of Portland and Seattle, I believe, because they hadn't played yet or they didn't play this week. So that's really impressive. 20,000 without the big teams that usually have these fanatic crowds of 40,000. And I was talking to a colleague of mine today just about how I really have seen the development of soccer, football in the United States the last 2 years, just even 2 years with Fox assigning a show, Chelsea and Manchester United on Fox across the country, and NBC picking up this new deal for the EPL. Would you agree on that assessment? I know it really went up after the World Cup in 2010, but would you say in the last 2 years, with the things I just said, showing national games on local cable, NBC, such money to get the rights for the EPL, do you think in the last 2 years we've seen something special?
I think it's been very special. I also think it's two things. First of all, that many clubs have built soccer-specific stadiums, starting back very early with the Columbus Crew and now going all the way to the BBVA Compass Stadium, putting the city in the last few years to their beautiful stadiums. And then you have the addition of what they call the Cascadia teams, which are those teams in the Northwest, Portland, Vancouver, the Seattle, and those are teams that are getting sold out every game. And then Seattle, sometimes, especially with Dempsey coming in, unfortunately, he's hurt now, but eclipsing 60,000. So they've bought up the attendance to rival the top leagues in Europe. And I think that the biggest things have been not only, like you said, that they're showing the game and that it's growing and their national recognition that it's getting, but also the fact that they're building these soccer-specific stadiums, and also that the MLS did such a great job of bringing teams within the last few years into the hotbeds of soccer within the Northwest, within the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah, I mean, even the Northeast, I remember Montreal, I believe, when they first had their first game of the season. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they had an opening crowd of over 60,000.
Yeah, it's Montreal, first of all, I like to call them the retired Italian national team. There's so many former Italian internationals. And that's something that you want to see, Montreal hotbed soccer. Same with Toronto FC, in ninth place right now in the Eastern Conference. One of the worst records in the league, and have been pretty terrible consistently every single year, and yet their fans have just unbelievable, and they're at every single game, and they're selling it out, and they've been unbelievable. So the support, even for the teams that haven't done well, has just been amazing. I mean, DC United, winning the U.S. Open Cup despite having the second worst record in the league behind Chivas USA, and for them to win the U.S. Open Cup, I think it was huge for their fans because they still get 15 to 17 in every single game as well, despite how bad they've been doing. So we're starting to see a trend that goes back to Europe and South America, where you support your team year after year and you go to the game no matter how bad they are. I mean, even Chivas doesn't draw as many people. I just give so much credit to the fans that do show up, because they show up and they party, and even with the fact that they were down 5-0, they were still there having a good time, wearing their team's colors and supporting their teams. And that's exactly, I think, what soccer's all about. I mean, obviously, we've seen it in a lot of countries get ugly, but you see after the first or second goal is scored against your team, it only makes the fans sing louder. And I think that's one of the more beautiful parts about football at the beginning versus crowds in other sports before, three or four goals get scored on it and it starts to get ugly, but we won't go there.
Right. Speaking of all these teams, I'm trying to think of, I know I'm mumbling here, but I have it in my head. Do you really believe that this league can expand to the point where you'll be walking downtown in any, Kansas City or no, that was a bad example because I know they have a good fan support. I'm trying to think of, just a guy randomly wearing an MLS jersey. I mean, we don't see that often. Is that something that could happen that people, you know, post Facebook statuses when their favorite team loses? Because now it's all, you know, oh no, the Colts lost or the Broncos. You know, we don't see that on social media as much. But are we getting to a level maybe where also Americans might say, oh, what a goal by Fernando Torres for Chelsea, or what a play by Wayne Rooney of Manchester United? Is this something that you've seen as working in the soccer media in the United States, you know, outside of soccer? Is this something you've just seen just living your normal life, traveling around?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people wearing T-shirts or jerseys of teams, not only in the home city. I mean, I'm in L.A. I saw somebody wearing a Philadelphia Union collar shirt the other day. I see on Twitter all the time people talking about not only international games, but the MLS games as well. And I think that the MLS has done a really good job getting itself, and it's starting to work its way into the mainstream, I think, to the point they're talking about expansion to 24 teams, and that's something that actually scares me, because I think that you don't want to overdo it. I think about the fact that, you know, the English Premier League, they're capped at 20 teams. Germany caps itself at 18 teams, and you don't want to dilute the talent pool at the top division. I mean, you think about Thomas Cohen, if it's only 16, and the bottom line is that, you know, that's only 6 teams, but just think about how good you had to be on one of those 6 rosters. And I think that, you know, it's kind of like the World Cup. We, you know, when it was 24 teams, it was the best teams in the world. And then you talk about expanding the European championships as well. And you don't want to dilute that talent pool too further where you're having these minnows getting killed in every tournament. So I would like to see MLS continue to grow, but I'd like to see them cap it and not try and be like these other leagues, like where there's 32 teams and the talent pool gets diluted. And so that's one thing that I'm a little worried about, because I see the growth in terms of the fans. I see the growth in terms of the way people talk about it on Twitter and they follow it on social media. And at the same time, I also don't want to see it grow to the point where it expands beyond itself and it's too much to handle. And we have certain teams that just aren't good enough because the talent pool gets so diluted.
All right, Mark, let's end our MLS talk with this question and move on to one or two questions. We don't have much time about England's team in the World Cup qualifiers. But last question, MLS, a lot of talk coming through that David Beckham is very, very close to purchasing a team in Miami. We know that it's been, a lot of people have tried to do it. I'm blanking on the name, but I know a Bolivian has been working on it for a long time, and he might have been teaming up with Beckham. You know, you just gave a great argument about why expansion is a problem. But as a person who was in Miami this past summer to see Chelsea and Real Madrid in the Guinness Cup, and I saw 76,000 people, and I spoke to Dolphins intern, media intern, a young guy who told me this was more people they had seen than almost 2 seasons worth of Dolphins games. So I think if a team should go anywhere, it definitely should be Miami. You know, David Beckham, you know, we can talk about him for hours. There's not much to say. What do you think about this? I mean, is this the right move to bring a team to Miami?
I think so, but I think a lot of things have to be very different. I think the first thing that we've kind of seen is what David Beckham wants, David Beckham gets. So I wouldn't be surprised that if something does materialize. At the same time, a lot of things have to be done differently. Remember, there was a Miami team in the early part of MLS, and it failed along with a team in Tampa Bay as well. So things are going to have to be done very differently. I mean, Miami MLS team is not going to have the same pool as the teams we got at that Guinness International Tournament. So they're going to have to do a lot of things differently. They're going to have to market really well, going to have to really hype it, and they're going to find a way to bring in that international community and get them just as excited about these games as you talked about watching the international games on TV, because they weren't able to tap into that international community that's in Miami the first time. And so that's something that they have to be very wary of, especially in Florida, is to not make the same mistakes and have it fail for a second time. Before we move on, I just want to say one more thing about the MLS, is that right now only one team is qualified for the playoffs, and that's the New York Red Bulls. So we still have the supporter shield up for grabs. We still have all the playoff places up for grabs. There are very few teams who are out of the playoff race. And as Landon Donovan said last Friday, you know, everybody talks about how relegation and promotion, and they think that would make the MLS more exciting. Well, just look at the MLS this year. This is definitely a league to follow, as each team has just 3 or 4 games left, because so many of these teams are still in the playoff hunt, and every single game matters right now. And it's not like baseball where so many team seasons are over in April. So this is something that's definitely worthwhile paying attention to, I think, not only across the U.S., but around the world, because even teams that are sitting in seventh place still have a chance to sneak into the top five. So it's going to be a very interesting run down the stretch in Major League Soccer.
Yeah, no, great point there, and it's always exciting no matter what sport when things are tight at the end, even hockey or sports that aren't my favorite. I still like to watch, you know, if there's this big game or you know, a baseball game when there's two outs, one strike, and it could be elimination. So it sounds like it's going to be very, very exciting, Mark. And, of course, international football is going on this week, so you're not going to be broadcasting until – when's your next game?
I think my next game isn't until the 26th because we don't do the week games. So we're doing the final game. It's Chivas USA at home versus Portland. So that's the next game I'll be doing. But I will be on Champions League duty for Fox Sports. I think I have to look at the grid one more time, but I think I'm looking at Marseille versus Napoli. So that will be a very fun game to be hosting. So I'm very excited about that on the next match day.
Definitely, Napoli with Insigne and so many other great stars. Hamšík, of course, as well, the Slovakian. Let's move on now real quick. You know, we wanted to talk on this more, but it's okay. We won't. Well, next week what we will do for everyone is we'll have our show Tuesday night, so we'll recap pretty much for the most part. We'll know a lot of teams that are in the World Cup. We'll talk about the teams in the playoffs, and we'll also look at what's going on in the second round, or the second leg, excuse me, of Africa playoff, because there's five games there, so we'll talk about that, or four games. But English team has announced who they're playing. Roy Hodgson, the manager of England, has announced who is going to be playing in crucial matches against Montenegro and Poland. And, you know, I was reading the list to you before we went on air, and it's kind of a scary list, as in it's not that impressive. Let's read it for our listeners real quick. Joe Hart, you know, even with his struggles, you got to think he's going to start. Over other, you know, John Rudy, of course. I don't see, you know, anyone taking his spot. The defenders, Gary Cahill, Ashley Cole, Phil Jones, Chris Smalling, Kyle Walker. Midfielders, Ross Barkley, Michael Carrick, Tom Cleverley, Steven Gerrard, Frank Lampard, James Milner, Jack Wilshere from Arsenal. Forwards, Jermaine Defoe from the Spurs, Ricky Lambert, who's just been an amazing story, you know, League One football action to what was it, a worker at a construction worker or something like that. Wayne Rooney, of course, Daniel Sturridge, and Daniel Welbeck. And I just, you know, I read it and I was said to myself, wow, this isn't most impressive team for a crucial World Cup game. Just to remind everyone, they're in a tight group. They're 1 point ahead of Ukraine and Montenegro. Ukraine, not Shevchenko anymore. Most of their players play in Ukraine, but still a team that's been able to play pretty well. They have 15 points. England has 16. Montenegro, in addition, 15 points. I don't know. Is this a player? I mean, we know players are injured. We know that. But is it maybe that the English team is not as good as it always is hyped up to be? What do you think about this lineup that we just announced here?
I mean, there's definitely the mainstays there, and then also some surprises. I mean, I don't think you're going to see a player like Ross Barkley get playing time. I think he's along for the ride. He's along for training, and it's because he deserves to be there. Andros Townsend is a player that's pressed me at times, but he can kind of be on off the radar. I think he's another player that's kind of along for the ride as well. There's still be the same players that you would normally see. I think that Wayne Rooney has been in tremendous form. Sometimes he's either on or off for England. If he's on, England's going to be fine. Danny Welbeck has scored some great goals for him. It'll be interesting to see whether it's Sturridge alongside Rooney or Welbeck alongside Rooney. I expect them to go with their normal two banks of four with their two forwards, which, to be honest, watching England in the last few years hasn't really been that exciting, but they're England, so I'm always going to watch them. I expect Ricky Lambert, especially Sturridge, if he doesn't start, to come off the bench. I think that they're behind the center of defense. Gary Cahill, very good. Phil Jones, Chris Smalling, still very young, but Phil Jagielka is, you know, has plenty of experience, and you also have Leighton Baines, who will get forward down the flank. You know, once again, the question is, will Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard, who both have over 100 caps, or Frank Lampard on 100 caps and Steven Gerrard 105, and can they play together? Will they play together? Michael Carrick, once again, will he be that link? He's one of those players who does all those little things that that a lot of people don't really see, but he does all those things right. And I think that one of the big things is if Jack Wilshere gets it, can he be that creative spark that sometimes seems to be missing from that England midfield? So there's a lot of questions we ask. Can Gerrard and Lampard play together? That seems to be the question we ask every single game. Where will Carrick be? I think Tom Cleverley would be a good option off the bench, shows a lot of grit. And Jack Wilshere, just 21 years old, if he starts, can he be that, you know, that creative number 10 that I think has been lacking for him? But I think they're going to be okay. You know, their first game is against Montenegro. I think that that's 3 points for them. It's not going to be easy, but that's a game that we'll be playing at home that will be very important for them. I think they have to be more worried about Poland. Poland obviously has their Borussia Dortmund players. They're a very, very strong squad. That game at home as well, but I think that's the game where England really needs to be worried about whether or not they're going to drop points. But if they get that one about against Montenegro, they'll have a little separation. I think that they'll be sitting pretty comfortably, and then they have to tear the Poland side, which I think is much more threatening than Montenegro, and I think probably one of the biggest challengers as well for those top two spots in that group.
Right, I agree. I think the Montenegro game is going to be tough, and I'm actually going to go ahead with a tie and say that they'll tie, but, you know, we'll see what happens. Just to recap real quick before we go, Group A, Belgium is in total control, and you know, Mark, we're going to have a segment in the next couple weeks that really outlines the potential of this Belgian team and how good they could be. Right now they're ranked 6th, I believe, in FIFA's rankings, and that sounds a bit crazy, but then you look at their lineup, and you realize how much talent they have, especially in the youth. So that'd be really fun to really look at their team and discuss it. Anyway, they have 22 points. They're in the World Cup. Italy's in the World Cup. Germany in the World Cup in Group C. Group D, Netherlands are in the World Cup. Group E, it looks like Switzerland are for sure in the World Cup. Group F, Israel's group, pretty tight with Russia and Portugal. They're still battling it out. Doesn't look like my beloved Israel is going to make it. Group G, Bosnia, and Greece. I'm very lucky, Mark. I don't know if I told you this, but I'm going to be in Greece this weekend, in Crete. So I'm going to get to watch football with Greek people. So I'm pretty excited for that. They have a big match coming up as well. Group H, we just outlined, and Group I, with Spain and France. They're still toe-to-toe, but France has played 7 matches. Spain has played 6. You know, I don't see Spain not winning this. It doesn't make sense for them to be in the playoff. And if for some reason they go to the playoff, they're going to advance. We have, of course, African matches as well, but we spoke about that in the past segment, so we won't get into it now. Champions League and all European action returns in a couple weeks. Big games in the Europa League, big games in the Champions League. City, Mark, as we said, I think, on the show, we both said they just can't, you know, I think we did the show before their match against Bayern, and we both said, you know, we thought they'd give a fight, but they wouldn't win, and we were both right. They came up short, and, you know, unless they win this match, they look like they're going to be in trouble. And that's, again, the third exit in a row for them, not making the group stages. Then, of course, they'll go to the Europa League, and who knows what will happen there. Whew, I'm talking a lot. Mark, as always, everyone can check out Mark on Soccer Server, also Chivas USA, and he'll be doing Champions League studio for Fox Soccer. He said, Mark, you said Marseille and Napoli.
I believe I have to double check that, but I'm pretty sure that that's what I'm doing. It's a couple weeks away, but I'm pretty sure that that's the game that I'm doing, and I'm really excited once again to be back with Fox Sports hosting the Champions League, and also hoping that Chivas USA can finish off strong, because it's a group of players that works really hard and has a great attitude despite all the adversity that they've been through this year. So I wish the best for them as well, not only just because I commentate for their team, but because I see the work that they put in every day, and it is a good group of guys. So,
and they'll will be up against Portland Timbers. That'll be good. Timbers are a good team, very, very good fan base, and that'll be fun for you. That'll be the last game of the season, and hopefully you'll get that gig next year for the whole season. That's what we'll be hoping for you here. Mark, as always.
Yes, please start a campaign for that.
Everyone who listens to our show, go to Twitter and hashtag Mark Serber Chivas USA. Stam. Just kidding, as we say, or Stam, as we say here in Israel, just means just kidding. Mark, a pleasure as always. Next week we'll come on. As I said, I think we'll do the show maybe later in the week so that we can recap the Friday matches and the Tuesday matches, so we can pretty much, you know, summarize the international break and talk about which teams have qualified. The European playoff draw won't be till later, but we'll be able to talk about who's in it, who we expect to move on. Obviously, we won't know until the fixtures, but we'll be able to tell. It looks like there'll be some good teams. I mean, it looks like France could be in it. Portugal could be in it. I'm just looking around right now. Sweden could be in it. Greece might be in it. So there'll definitely be Croatia will be in it. There'll be some very, very strong teams in the playoff. And you know, that's just such an intense series. So much to play for. World Cup, Mark, what I think I just read, so, what, 200 days away? We're getting close. Very, very close.
Yes.
Make
your plans for Brazil if you haven't yet. Price is about to go up.
I wish. But, yeah. Great show, as always. Kicking It With Rafael, Season 2, Episode 3. I want to thank James Montague, a reporter, a contributor to New York Times, CNN, was on BBC World Sport Radio. Really, really great book that you should check out. All the details he mentioned earlier, it's available on Amazon. You can follow him on Twitter as well. Then, of course, as always, Mark Serber, working with Divas USA and with Fox Soccer doing Champions League and whatever they call upon him, at Soccer Serber on Twitter. Mark, have a good day. I know it's early there. It's late here. I'm going to go finish some work, and you're going to start your day. So thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, Rafi. Thank you.
See you later.